Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
Leslie Rule cut her teeth in true crime as a photographer and research assistant for her mother, the late true crime writer Ann Rule. And after years of writing best-selling books with paranormal themes, Leslie is out with her own true crime debut. It's called A Tangled Web, and it documents a deadly love triangle in Omaha, Nebraska. Leslie, you could have picked any number of cases for your true crime debut. How did this particular case make its way onto your radar?
Well, I was specifically looking for a case of a female sociopath. So that caught my eye right away. And as soon as I started to read up on it a little bit, I found it fascinating because there's so many twists and turns in this case. I knew it was the one that I wanted to investigate. But before I got very far into it, I checked with the victim's mother to make sure it was okay with her.
And that's got to be something that's important to you, to make sure to have that blessing, right?
Well, yes, because I would feel terrible if I wrote about somebody's tragedy and it made them feel worse.
So let's talk about it. The love triangle, it was two women and one man. It was Carrie Farver, Shanna Golier, and Dave Krupa. There weren't any secret affairs involved, and everything was pretty much out in the open between all of them, at least as far as their relationships is concerned. So how did this particular love triangle work, and was anyone really in love?
Well, Dave Krupa had recently gotten out of a relationship he'd been in for over a decade, and he really wanted to play the field. And he made that very clear when he first started dating. Unfortunately, the very first woman he met, Liz Golier, seemed to agree that that was fine, but he had no idea that she had a secret agenda. So that was a problem right there. She was very good at hiding her true motivations. And so he thought it was perfectly fine to date and to have an open relationship, but she dug her claws into him almost immediately. And he began to feel stifled, and he tried to break away from her. And when he met Carrie, Dave and Carrie had a potential to fall in love and be a real relationship. They were kindred spirits. They both liked to have fun. They saw the world in the same way. But unfortunately, they didn't get to spend much time together before Liz ended it in a really violent manner.
So Carrie ends up going missing, and Liz is back in with Dave. And it seemed like Dave did everything okay here. He was honest from the get-go and really just wanted a bunch of hookups. Would you agree that Dave really didn't do anything wrong in this situation?
Dave didn't do anything wrong. He crossed paths with evil. And none of us can ever know when that's going to happen. People do what he did every single day, and nothing bad happens to them. So he had no special powers to recognize evil when he saw it. And none of us really do. And that's one of the problems is when we meet a sadistic sociopath, we can't recognize them unless they allow us to. So there was really nothing he could have done to stop what happened, although now he wishes there was and he has guilt about it. It really wasn't his fault.
I don't know how much you want to give away of what actually happened here, but a great deal of the story involves law enforcement investigating a missing persons, and it's a couple years before it becomes a homicide investigation, and even then there were two different agencies investigating. So what challenges did this pose with the Iowa-Nebraska border in drawing out this investigation for so long?
Well, it was a real challenge because Iowa was looking at a missing persons case, while Omaha thought they were looking at a case of a stalker. And so there were two completely different jurisdictions, and they had no idea that the two cases were connected.
So as the investigation goes on, a couple years in, we meet Pottawatomie County Special Investigator Tony Cava. He stood out like an absolute rock star in this. What was his role?
Tony Cava is a digital forensic specialist, and so he was able to scrutinize fake emails and prove that they were indeed fakes and trace them to their source.
And so what did that prove?
That Liz Golier was impersonating Carrie Farber online. Carrie Farber had actually been murdered, and Liz took over her identity online and tried to make it appear that Carrie was alive and was stalking her and Dave.
And so Dave's going through this. He thinks he's being stalked by one person. It's actually not even that. So where's Dave's mindset throughout all of this?
Poor Dave. It was very confusing for him because Liz convinced him from day one that Carrie was a stalker and that Carrie was sending him threatening emails that he believed that Carrie would not leave him alone. He got over 10,000 emails and texts that he believed were from Carrie. And so he was completely in the dark about the fact that Liz was the real culprit.
Your investigation did a deep dive into the background of the major players in this case. Shauna Golier's past had to be the most gut-wrenching to investigate, right?
It took a while to find where she came from. And when I did, it kind of made sense where the monster came from. I think it's a combination of a genetic predisposition toward violence and also the very beginning of her life. In the very beginning of her life, she had some really horrible things happen. Her mother was hit by a car when she was under the age of 3, and she was separated from her family. But prior to that, she had witnessed her father, who was an extremely violent man, beat her mother every day of her life. So I think that may have had some influence on her. So I believe that Shauna Golier had a genetic predisposition toward violence, and that, combined with her upbringing, created the perfect monster.
As you did this research, did you learn anything new from your research that would have been helpful at the trial had it been known to law enforcement or the prosecution? Because you had the luxury of time.
I did. I had a lot of time to look into it. But the prosecution and the detectives had so much evidence that they actually couldn't even use it all. They had Anthony Kava's work, which had resulted in pages and pages and pages of evidence that showed fake emails, and he could trace them all to the source. And there were so many that the prosecutors actually had to cut some of them from the original plan because it would have just been too much because the trial was already so long as it was. So I think the things I found wouldn't have helped them get a conviction, but it does help people learning about the story understand how it all came to be.
Dave Krupa and his ex, Amy Flora, you had referenced her earlier, they almost seem like characters out of a Hitchcock film to me as I read this. They're ordinary folks who are flung into an awful situation that they have to deal with. Did Hitchcock ever come to your mind as you studied Dave and Amy?
You know, when you bring that up, it does, because there are so many twists and turns that it is very much like an Alfred Hitchcock movie. Like you say, there's a couple ordinary people going about their business, and there's all this stuff going on that they're not aware of.
There were a lot of victims in this case, not just Carrie Farber, but also Carrie's son, Maxwell, who was young when this happened, teenager. And so how did he deal not only with his mother's death, but 2 years of not knowing where she was?
Well, it was devastating to him. He and his mother were very, very close, and she went to all of his events. She was at his games and everything he participated in. So it was, of course, just absolute loss and a shock. But thankfully, he was very close to his grandparents, and they took him in. And I think he's a real strong young man, and I think he's going to do okay in life.
The prosecutors get this case, this massive document data dump from Tony Cava, all the other research collected by law enforcement. It must have been similar as to when you started investigating this. So how did they go about sorting this story all out to be able to tell it in court?
They admit they couldn't have done it without detectives Jim Doty, Ryan Avis, and Anthony Cava. Those three helped put it together for them. The detective, of course, had been studying it for years, and so the prosecutors asked to have Detective Ryan Avis at the table with them in the courtroom. And he had his computer, and any time they needed something, he could pull it up instantly.
The defense attorney, James Martin Davis, JMD, throughout the book, he seemed like a real character. Am I in the ballpark with that assessment?
He's really an interesting, charismatic man, and he's had a very interesting background. He is a war hero, and he's highly decorated with medals. He's been in the business for a long, long time, and he's got a lot of stories to tell.
He seemed very open with you. There were some things that he revealed in the book that I would think that a defense lawyer may not have wanted to reveal, and yet I'm sure you did all your due diligence to make sure that everything was okay with him. Did you get the feeling that he didn't hide the ball with you at all?
No, he didn't, but I think he felt it was safe because she'd already appealed and that had been denied, and he felt comfortable telling me some things.
Growing up with a true crime writer for a mother, as an adult, are you now more appreciative of some of the concerns that she probably had for you as a child and as a young adult as you research a story like this one?
Definitely. When I was a teenager, I was really annoyed when my mom lectured me. And she seemed to be so worried about everything. And I loved to walk, and I would go out at night, walk, and she would worry, and she'd go to sleep, and I'd sneak out the back door and, you know, walk around town. And I thought I was fine. I thought I was safe. And it's only now, looking back, I realized that she had every right to be worried.
You know, I still remember reading The Stranger Beside Me when I was in high school, and I've read it a couple of times since then. Your mom's really the breakout writing that she did and made her the superstar that she was. You summarize the story in your book here that she actually knew Ted Bundy before he became the Ted Bundy that we all knew. And now I can't flip through my TV grid without seeing a documentary of Ted Bundy. Can you even see that name anymore without thinking back and looking at him through the lens of your mother's eyes?
Well, I actually met Ted when I was about 14, and I never saw him the same way she did. I thought there was something off about him. I met him in summer of 1972. My two best friends and I had gone to the Rolling Stones concert in downtown Seattle, and my mom that night was volunteering at the crisis clinic on the suicide hotline with her partner, Ted Bundy, and she did not want me waiting for the bus after the concert because she didn't think it was safe. So she went down, she left her shift, and she went down and picked us up and brought us back to the crisis clinic where we would be safe with her and Ted. And I remember meeting him, and it's not that I can say that I felt evil, but something was off. And it was mostly because when she introduced us, he would not look me in the eye. And, you know, we were 14, and we were, you know, cute little girls, and we were used to, you know, guys would always, you know, kind of flirt with us and look at us. And it was just strange that here was this man that wouldn't even meet my eyes as my mom was introducing us. He kind of ducked his head, and he made a little joke, and that was it. And we, after my mom introduced us, my friends and I went into the other room, and we played Chinese checkers and hung out there. And my two friends went on and on about how cute he was, and they're giggling about him, and I felt kind of left out, and I thought, what's wrong with me that I can't see what they're seeing?
And then, of course, as we all know, your mother's hired to write a book about these murders that are happening. Little does she know, it turns out to be a man she worked with, who she was friends with.
She always said it would not have worked in fiction because it would have been too contrived, but it was real life. you know, what are the odds that she gets a contract to write a book about murders, and only to find that her friend is the killer.
And she was hired before he was ever found out, right?
Yes. She actually sent in a proposal to an editor in New York to write a book about these girls disappearing around Seattle. And at the time, the leading theory among detectives was that it was a cult sacrificing maidens. So that's kind of the direction the book was going to go in. And it was her first book contract, and the stipulation was that if the case was not solved, the book would not be published. And she had no idea that her friend was going to be the killer.
And at that point, you want to go in and renegotiate your contract when you find that out, right?
I don't think she was thinking like that. I think she was worried they weren't going to publish it, because even after she wrote it, her editor said to her, you know, I don't know if we're going to publish this. No one's ever heard of Ted Bundy.
Oh, my Lord.
But he saw it through, and the book's been in print ever since. And what, 40 years?
Yeah, it would be almost 40 years now, so just that's unbelievable. Well, I tell you what, I am so glad that you broke into the nonfiction crime genre, because this book was just an absolute joy to read. I read it in about 2 or 3 hours here. It, of course, had the local flavor, but the story is a universal one. It's a Tangled Web. It's by Leslie Rule. The book is now available wherever your fine books are sold, and now is a great time to pick up some books and read them and enjoy them and learn the cautionary tales from all of them. Leslie, just a great offering from you, and I thank you for joining us to talk about it.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it, Brian.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time. Hey, jealousy. Hey, jealousy.